Okay, great. So the idea, as I was saying, was right to try to, you know, get as much information as we can from these biological systems and try to model them, you know, from a mathematical point of view and try to sort of reproduce, you know, just, you know, broadly speaking, the patterns that we see. Okay, now, why are we, you know, interested in all this? Well, because again, in the natural world around us, we see lots of examples of organisms that are able to self-assemble. Now, these are just some, you know, examples that you can take, and you can see that, right? These self-organizing systems vary across different time scales and different length scales. But at the end of the day, there is some, you know, organizing principle, principle in all of these systems. Okay, and the idea is then that, again, if we can learn some lessons, even basic lessons from these natural systems, maybe we can try to incorporate these lessons. Yes.
What bacteria do that?
I don't know what bacteria this is. This is interesting. I don't know.
I know. Do they just like spread them around on a plate?
Maybe it's okay. Because they've done something to the to the preparation of it. I don't know. First time anybody asks that question.
If you wait like 4 months, and then
but anyway, the idea is, right, is to learn something from these systems and try to apply them to man-made systems so that we can have our teams of structures doing things that are maybe too difficult or too dangerous for, you know, human-operated systems. For example, in case like underwater exploration, space exploration, or even more military-applied systems. Okay? And of course, right, individuals, you know, have limited capabilities at times, and it's better to have a team that, you know, is maybe more resilient to failure or that can actually coordinate tasks in a better way. Okay. Right, you know, this is, of course, we're talking about biological systems, so a lot of communities have approached these topics, right, from behavioral ecology to evolutionary biology, and we're going to take, you know, of course, a mathematical approach. But, you know, these other fields have tried to ask the question, like, you know, why do these organisms self-assemble? What purpose are they serving? So sometimes you have a positive effects that come out of this self-organization. For example, right, you're able to protect your juvenile members by maybe putting them at the center of your swarm. You can deceive predators because you can look bigger than what you actually are if you all come together. It can be easier to find a mate. It can be easier to, for example, move in a fluid, and there may be other kinds of survival strategies. On the other hand, you can also have negative consequences of this swarming. For example, you are all competing for the same resources. You can, you know, by the different token of deceiving predators, you can also be an easier target because, again, you look bigger than you are. Diseases can spread more easily, and sometimes you can even see examples of cannibalism in these systems. Okay? And sometimes these structures just arise by chance. There is actually no real reason, and they're just, again, some kind of system that just, you know, fell into this by mistake, and actually it can be quite deleterious. And what you see down here, this is an example from, you know, 1944, and there was this professor of, he was an expert of insect behavior, and he spent, like, you know, 2 years in the jungles of Panama trying to look for how ants behaved and interacted. And what he found, you know, just by chance one night, were these ants that were aggregating in these mills, and he followed their motion for 2 days until all the ants died of starvation. And that's because ants are very, in a sense, they follow the leader to an extreme, and so they all kept milling. Nobody had the courage to leave the mill, and so they all died to death. Marched to their death. Okay, so again, and that's just, there's no real reason for that happening. It just so happened by mistake. Okay, now it's going to be very important in all this to be able to model and to understand the interactions between these individuals, and we can actually break down interactions into three different types. Sometimes these interactions are mediated by the background. So basically, all these individuals are not necessarily really talking to each other. They're actually following the same chemical or physical field gradient. Okay, for example, everybody's following the source of food, some, you know, temperature gradient, some electromagnetic field. Sometimes you have instead direct information exchange. Maybe they see each other, they touch each other, they smell each other. And this usually happens when organisms are a little bit bigger. And other times you may have external agents that actually trigger the coming together of these particles. For example, sometimes you see these fish that kind of will aggregate around some, you know, external object. Okay, we are going to be mostly concerned with number two, where we're going to assume that there's some kind of direct information exchange between the particles. Okay. And as I was saying before, right, it's going to be, you know, interesting to understand these interactions and how microscopic interactions give rise to macroscopic effects, especially when it comes to, you know, trying to have these lessons of nature applied to artificial systems. And this was a system that was being studied by Professor McClurkin, and he actually gave this interview to PBS some years ago, where he said that I don't attribute emergent behaviors to amazing insights and interactions among robots. I attribute them to me, the engineer, not understanding the system. One example of an emergent behavior that I was unanticipating is that I was trying to get these robots to spread evenly throughout the environment, trying to have them move so that there were robots everywhere in the room, leaving no empty spaces. But then I made a mistake in the program. I flipped some signs in the equations, and when I ran the software, the robots formed into little clumps. They essentially made polka dots on the floor, which was very entertaining after the fact, right? So this really shows that, you know, changing just a little bit, these microscopic interactions can give to macroscopic, discrepancies. Okay? And so again, our job is to try to understand how to change things microscopically and how these effects are going to be from a macroscopic scale. Okay? So this, from a mathematics and physics point of view, the first people to try to study this were about 20 years ago, Wiesek and his collaborators, and they had a very simple system. They had, and this is in box A over here, a set of individual random elements that were moving at a constant speed, but the speed, the velocity could change direction, okay? And the way that they changed their direction was by aligning with others. So basically, I sit here, I look at everybody within a certain radius around me, I see where they are going, and I'm going to go exactly the same place, okay? And what happens is that if you start from a collection of random individuals, and you have low noise, okay, low perturbations, and you have high density, so there's a lot of these individuals, what you see is that in the long run, you're going to find some emerging common direction, okay? So they're all going to go in the same way, okay? And this, again, happens if noise is low and if the density is high enough, of course, okay?
What do you implement noise in this, something like that?
It's basically little kicks, right? So basically, let's say I have to go this way, and then instead of going this way, I go a little bit to the left or a little bit to the right. And whether I go to the left or to the right is basically random. Okay?
It's like making the wrong decision.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Okay.
Maybe we'll get to this, but do you implement that as a sort of general, this percentage of the time, make the wrong error in the following way? And then you just apply that randomly across all elements?
No, I mean, I didn't do this particular simulation, but the way that I believe they did it is that, again, you, at time step one, you look around you and you make a decision on where you're going to go, okay? And then you say, okay, this is where I'm going to go, now I'm going to make an error. Instead of going straight ahead, I am going to go, in this other direction with this probability. And I'm going to pick a probability from a certain distribution. It can be to the left or it can be to the right. Okay.
So then, can you calculate things like if the goal is to get everybody to go this direction, you can calculate things like how many mistakes they can make, or what are the parameters within which individual how many mistakes can you make?
No, right. So the point is that there's going to be a critical value of this noise, uh-huh. Okay, which basically measures the mistake. That basically, if this noise is too high, okay, uh-huh. if the mistake that you're allowing is too big, uh-huh. okay, then you're not going to see the ordering effect, okay? Because again, essentially, you're not keeping this the common direction. Everybody's basically, going wherever they want to go.
So do you have a number?
It's a critical value, but I don't know what it is. But you can actually estimate it here, okay? Supposed to be eta, didn't it come out? It came out as eta, I don't know why, but it's eta critical. That's a critical noise. Okay, beyond that, you can't go. Okay? All right, and again, and this was later applied to other actually real systems, in particular of locusts. Okay, they tried to apply this to study the ordering of locust systems. Okay, but again, this was 20 years ago. The way that we're going to look at it is slightly different. So we're not going to have these, rules, but we're going to have actually equations of motion for these particles. Okay, so every particle is I, label I, and then we have, of course, right, Newton's equations: mass times acceleration is equal to some force. Okay, so this is the acceleration is dv by dt. Okay. And the force is given by these two components, where U is the potential, and the potential is given in this particular way, okay? And we'll get into all these terms one at a time just to make it clear, okay? Now, the first term here is what we call the Rayleigh friction, okay? And what happens here is that if you do the multiplication, this is alpha times V, okay? And this means that, so this is the force acting on the particles, this is the acceleration. So this is a self-accelerating term, okay? This is if alpha is positive, okay? So alpha times V, if this is big, it means that the particles want to go faster, okay? So this is an accelerating term, okay? This one here is negative, so just as this is accelerating, this is going to be decelerating, okay? So it makes them stop. Okay, and why do we like this particular form? Because you see, if alpha makes you accelerate and beta v squared makes you decelerate, there's going to be a very, very special value of v squared, which is the square root of alpha over beta, okay, which makes this term zero. Okay, if v squared equals to alpha over beta, okay, this term is zero. Okay, and that means that this, in some sense, represents the self-propelling component of our model. Okay, basically, particles keep gathering energy from the environment and pushing back energy to the environment through these two terms until they find an equilibrium. Okay, so I pump enough and I push out enough so that this term goes to zero. Okay, so that's one effect that we're going to have. Okay, right? Because again, if you want to find some kind of equilibrium, you basically want this to be zero. Okay, so to make this zero, you're going to make this term zero by making v squared equals to alpha over beta, so there is no term here, and that basically tells you that the particles are going at this speed. Okay, that's one thing.
Why do we want people? So
we don't want them to be. If
no, so you're saying we want this to be zero.
I mean, the dynamics will evolve in such a way that this is going to be zero.
Right.
So the way that this is going to happen is that they're going to assemble at this particular speed. So basically, particles will move at a fixed velocity. And we include this term just because of that purpose.
Does zero mean a steady state of motion, or does zero mean no motion?
No, it means a steady state. It means that the velocity will be constant.
Okay.
Right? dv by dt is zero, so v is constant. Okay. So it can either be zero or it can be some number. So you can. This is one trend that you have, okay? And the other trend is to make this term also zero. And we'll talk about that just in a moment, okay? So right, this is the frictional part that gives you the self-propelling term, and then you have here the Morse potential, okay? So this is another force that comes in this particular way, and it's basically this force is the derivative of some potential. And the important thing to see here is that this potential, this represents interaction between particles, okay? Here you only have particle I, okay? Here you have particle I talking to particle J, okay? So it has this particular mathematical form that is such that, again, I talks to J and you're summing over all possible J's. So I am, as individual I, I'm talking to everybody else, okay? And you see that, first of all, this term U has got some exponential decay, and that means that, you know, the further particle J is from me, the less important it's going to be, right? Because this is going to decay to zero, and then you have some amplitudes here, A and R, okay? And just because of the way mathematically this comes about, the minus part is an attraction, and the plus part is a repulsion. So the way this turns out to be, the way that we're going to pick these parameters, CA, LA, CR, LR, is such that we're going to have a repulsion at short terms, because I don't want to, right, interfere in somebody else's space, but attraction at long term. Okay? This is the way that this is going to be modeled. Okay? And again, so you see that in order for acquire the steady state, where again the velocity is going to be a constant, you want the self-propelling term to be given by v squared equals to alpha over beta, and these particles to be assembled at the minimum of this potential. Right? This is a derivative, so if you're at the minimum, this term here is zero. Okay? So this gives you some preferential positions and some preferential speeds for your motion. So, okay, all this is talk. Now let's just decide to put this into our computer. And we have here some parameters that we're just going to pick at random for the time being. Yes?
Just a very basic question. Right. Mm-hmm. Never think about things like this.
Yeah.
So these formulas that you've shown us, those are like, everybody knows those are like...
Well, it's not that everybody, it's just, you know, you can use any kind of formula that you like, but this is typically what are used in this kind of field, just because they're easy to work with. They, again, they have this nice property that they decay at infinity, And, you know, you can actually work with it. But you can pick other types of potentials, too. Sometimes you can put here, for example, a denominator with another power of xi minus xj. You can pick other shapes of these things. But really what you want is, again, is that at infinity they go to 0. And that, again, they have some, you know, capabilities that you can kind of, you know, manipulate them.
So basically, you have a question. You find if there's tools that people have already developed that sort of answer these sorts of things, and now you're going to put them together to answer your particular...
Correct. Okay. But this potential has actually mostly been developed for this kind of studies, these kinds of fish behavior, etc. Okay. Okay. Now, let's put them in the computer so what you see. And again, here, I'm just going to pick for now, we're going to pick parameters at random. Okay. We don't know what these parameters mean. I'm just going to pick them at random, put them in the computer. And these are 100 particles, if I'm not mistaken. And boundary conditions are free, meaning that if the particles wanted to, they could escape from each other. Okay. They have the entire space at their disposal. Okay. So I hope... it was working just before I started this, and I came before just to check on it. Why isn't it working? I don't know what to say. Maybe there's some interference with the projector, but...
the clock is moving.
Oh, this is bad. Let's see if I can find it from here. Okay, so we'll see. We'll look at it from here. So again, this is the first set of parameters that I was showing here. And right, again, as I said, if the particles wanted to, they could escape wherever they want, but they stay all together because of these interactions. And you see that it's still kind of confused, but slowly, some order will emerge, and you will see that, right, there's going to be a nice coherent pattern where everybody's going to rotate in this kind of disk. It's going to take some time, but they will kind of find some consensus, okay? And you will also see that in this picture that arises, they will actually, the center of mass will keep moving, okay? So you see that they're going to form a rigid disk, and right, everybody's kind of happy together, okay? And this comes out without any leaders, okay? It's just the self-organization of the particles that brings you to this, okay? Now, this was just a set of parameters. Now, let's decide that we're going to move to these other parameters, which are, again, it's like the same exact model, but the parameters that are down here, okay? For now, they just don't mean anything except some, you know, numbers that we're going to pick at random. So in this case, what we're going to see is this kind of structure. And again, same thing. If the particles wanted to, they could also, you know, escape to infinity. And what you see here is that it's going to be, you know, a nice pattern also, but slightly different in the sense that there's going to be a hole at the middle, and the center of mass will not be moving. It'll be more or less centered on the origin. Okay? And this is the contrarian you were talking about from the Monterey Aquarium. Okay? But eventually he's going to remind and follow the rest. Okay? So in this case here, you see a hole in the middle. Okay.
So what are the starting conditions that you
in use? Random. Everything is random, yes. They're inside some confined box, as you saw, but then we let the confined box, you know, just disappear. And again, if they wanted to, they could escape to infinity. They stay together because of these interacting forces.
You see different dependencies on the starting states?
Not really. It doesn't really depend too much on the starting conditions, meaning that at the end of the day, you will, if you pick these parameters, it doesn't really matter what initial conditions you start with. Most of the times you'll end up in these patterns here. Sometimes you can end up in flux in 2D, okay? And I haven't shown the flux because they're easier. They're just basically all the particles are parallel and they all move together, okay? But that's very rare, yes?
Is that depends that the typical distance between the particles is approximately the same at the beginning?
Not really. No, it doesn't. We've tried like that. It doesn't, because at the beginning there's all this. All the particles are sort of going to.
Even if you start them from two different.
They will, well, if you put them in two different patches, most likely they will never come into contact with each other because they don't talk to each other, right? Those exponential decays are so strong that they're not going to be able to talk. But generally speaking, it's very hard for them to form anything else that's not a male. To have them form a flock is very, very difficult and only very special initial conditions that don't really necessarily depend. Basically, you have to start them almost in a flock to begin with for them to stay in a flock. Okay? And that's because, again, flocking is an order. It's a global order, right? A flock where basically all these a flock means that all these particles are all aligned in the same direction and they're all moving in a certain direction, okay? And if you think about that, that's a state of global order. Everybody has to go in the same direction, okay? And that's much more difficult to attain than these kinds of structures where instead the order is only local, okay? We have to basically, you know, so.
So I was really sort of puzzled by what you were explaining to Shelley, that there are many ways to write the equations to describe the processes that you're talking about.
Right.
And one of the things that I've been trying to understand about how to use this technique of modeling is what you get out, how are you sure that it's not simply a function of what you've put in?
But that's true for every model that you have.
Whatever
is what you put in.
Right. Well, that's exactly. But I guess then, given that that's the case.
Right.
So I know, for example, when I do phylogenetics, I know I can think of things that I can do to try and mitigate that effect. Right. And I think you're right. I mean, it's exactly the problem of any technique. But for modeling, how do you convince yourself that what you're seeing is meaningful and not simply, well, I put all that in there and so it's not a new surprise.
Well, this was all about, again, we are still at the point where we just threw in numbers at random. So our goal now is to try to understand how to control these numbers so that I know what kind of structure I'm going to get out. That will be our goal, okay?
Okay.
So that is the, so our objective at this point is to be able to predict large-scale patterns,
okay,
starting from microscopic numbers that we pick.
Okay, and so the reason that, so what you've got is a model that has a certain behavior,
uh-huh,
and you put, I mean, essentially, you put that in,
right,
because of the model that you did. And then, because you see that behavior at all phases, or of all starting conditions, you can, what you're going to get out is to understand how the different starting conditions affect that behavior.
Okay, we can also look at how different starting conditions affect the behavior, but mostly we're interested in how so the starting conditions, you mean the initial conditions of the particles or these numbers that we pick? Because we can look at both.
I don't know. I mean, I guess to frame this, I'm very, very interested in potentially using this kind of technique to answer the types of questions I want to do. I just don't understand the utility of the technique yet. And so I'm hoping you can explain, like, what do you find some of the limitations? What do you think that this is particularly good for, in terms of your question, right?
Okay, right now, again, all we want to do is try to classify these behaviors in terms of the potential that we're putting in. That's all, you know, it's a very modest goal for the time being, and that's what we want to look at, okay? Because, right now, just like that guy was saying at the beginning, he makes a mistake in punching in the equations and he gets different patterns. So our goal here is to decide what you know, parameters go with what structures. That's all that really we want to do at this time. Okay. And because this is, you know, some, you know, complicated system, also we may see patterns that we don't expect and that we don't really know what they are, and just try to make sense of everything. Okay. So okay, let's go back to this now. So the question is, why do just different numbers lead to different behaviors? And also, what happens if instead of having 100 particles in each of these simulations, we actually add more? Okay, so first of all, you would think, well, I'm going to add more particles, and this is example 2, the second simulation that I showed you with the hole in the middle, okay? So you can say, well, I'm going to add more particles, probably the mill will become bigger, okay? That's maybe some idea. But instead, what we see is something completely different, because you add more particles, and actually you see that they become denser and denser, okay? So that must be something that comes out of these equations that we don't understand why and how, and, you know, how can we make sense of it, okay? So that's another question that arises just from, you know, doing these blind simulations without knowing any better. And also what you see, and I guess this is not going to work either, So let's go back to this. Here it is. Okay, so this is instead 200 particles. It is the same parameters that we use for the second run that I showed you before with the hole in the middle. And here what you see instead is that you have, right, some people going clockwise and a lot of contrarians that are going counterclockwise. Okay, and this actually persists for, you know, forever, okay? Where half the particle is going one direction and half the particle is going another direction. Okay?
So is there any objective way to see, to say that there's a pattern? It's when they start accelerating, when dvi dt gets to zero.
Well,
so here we see the pattern, but they say you can't, if you can't, how can you objectively see that, say that there's a pattern?
Well, you just basically follow them for long enough until you see some kind of order, but then you can also mathematically, actually mathematically define some ways of measuring things, like, you know, for the angular momentum or whatever, and you make them so that when this quantity is, you know, equal to one, it indicates, you know, perfect rotational thing or et cetera, right? Okay, for example, you can look at this, for example, a very simple indicator is the center of mass, okay?
Yeah.
If the center of mass is fixed to alpha over beta square root, that means that, you know, everybody's going at that same speed and they're all, and that could be an indicator for a flock, right? Because it means that everybody is moving at the same speed. If it's zero, it probably means that, right, everything is, you know, the center of mass is here, so it's not moving. It's not a complete indicator because, right, it could represent many other things, but that's an easy one. The more precise ones, again, deal with angular momentum, where you can actually define, you know, that everybody's moving in the same direction. Okay, so another question is then, why do we see these kinds of things and how can we explain that? Okay, and this, again, same values as here. Okay, as same numbers as here. The only thing that's different is that the speed is a little higher, alpha is a little higher, and the number of particles is actually greater. Okay, so we like to understand all this. Okay, so to understand all this, then, you know, we understand, you know, there's going to be something that this potential is doing in all of these cases that makes it so that these structures are different. And it must be the potential because it's the only thing that's changing between all of these simulations. Okay? And so we're going to take a step back and we're going to take some lessons from statistical mechanics. Okay? Now, statistical mechanics is concerned with many things, but one of them is to try to understand a macroscopic system and its behaviors starting from small microscopic components. Okay? And there is one particular, concept in StatMech is that if you want a large-scale behavior, okay, similar to the ones that we're accustomed to seeing in everyday life, meaning that the more particles you put, for example, the more volume, you know, gets occupied, these interactions have to obey some constraints. They must be tempered, which means that interactions must decay at large distances, and we have that. And they also must obey this thing called H stability, okay? And it's a mathematical requisite that I'll tell you in just a little bit, but it basically means that if these particles satisfy this condition of H stability, you will have what is called extensive behaviors, meaning the more particles you have, the larger volume you will have, the less particles you have, the less volume you will occupy. If this constraint is not satisfied, you have what is called catastrophic collapse, meaning the system is way too attractive and everybody's going to fall into the same point. Okay? And again, this has been, shown with these, you know, rigorous methods, etc. So another way of looking at it is in this way, right, StatMech, you start with microscopic parameters, and the job of StatMech is to take you from microscopic to macroscopic systems, okay? And here you have many variables, there you have few variables, okay? This is everything here is described in terms of, right, volume, density, and pressures. And again, if you want extensive behaviors, meaning more particles occupy more volume, you want this condition of H stability. If you don't have that condition of H stability, you have what is called catastrophic collapse, okay? And what is this condition of H stability mathematically? It's a condition that is applied to your interactions, okay? And it basically, all this is saying, it's just a mathematical way of saying that, look, your interactions, if you want them to be H stable, cannot be too attractive, okay? Because again, if everything is super attractive, then of course, everything is gonna fall off, okay? We don't want that. And actually, in our everyday life, you know, in most, you know, systems that we're accustomed to using, to dealing with, we don't have that problem of things collapsing, getting in, things are H stable, okay? And from this, you can find certain conditions on your, this is the general condition, and you can actually translate this into more simple conditions on your Morse potential that we can apply to our particular model. Okay, and one of the conditions that guarantees this H stability is that the integral of your potential has got to be negative. Okay, but again, if you have this, it has to be positive. If it's negative, it's going to be catastrophic. So basically, this means that take your potential, that Morse potential with those decaying terms. If the integral in space is negative, they're going to collapse to a point. That's what this means. Okay. And an example for that is shown here, okay? This is where the integral is positive, okay? It's positive here, it's negative here, and together they turn out to be positive because this is bigger than that. And here instead it's negative, okay? They have the same exact shape, okay? They both have a minimum over here, they both go to zero and infinity, but this has an integral that's positive, and this has an integral that's negative. And you can see that if I look at these things, for many, many particles, you will see that there's going to be a minimum of the energy per particle at a finite distance, okay? And here instead, it's going to be, this minimum will be zero. So basically, this means that at large distances, if I have many, many particles, basically, there's going to be a finite distance at which the particles want to assemble, okay? Yeah.
Is this independent of the kinetic terms you have?
Yes, this is just about the potential. Yes, we'll put in the kinetic terms.
It's for any kind of dynamics?
It's for any kind of potential, yes, yes.
So yes. Any kind of dynamics for the term where you put in energy with a negative friction?
No. This is just for the potential. This has got nothing. This is just to look at the long-time behavior, assuming there is no alpha, beta. Okay, this is just for the potential.
That would be simple dynamics without any kind of pumping in energy or taking it out.
What does it mean, simple?
Well, what are the particles doing? Are they driven by some kind of temperature? What's the dynamics of the particles here?
Well, okay, we're just looking here. Okay, this is just the condition that tells us that if you start these systems with particles at random, they are going to, coalesce into with certain interactions, okay? If your interaction is H stable, they will eventually assemble, in this nice ordered lattice configuration. If your interactions are catastrophic, they will all collapse to a point. That's all this is saying. And we're not looking here yet at the alpha and beta component. This is just looking at the interactions. Okay? You start them at random, your potential is catastrophic. At the end of the day, the dynamics will result in everybody coalescing at one point. You have an H stable potential. At the end of the day, you will see some kind of crystalline structure. That's all this is saying. Okay?
So there's nothing about thermodynamics here. It's just asking.
Right. It's just
stability of a certain state.
Right. Yes. Actually, that is where this is going to come from. Yes. Okay, so now we're going to take our potential, okay, and take this criterion, okay? There are actually other criterion as well, but we'll just, focus on this one for the time being and try to ask for our particular potential, the Morse potential with all those parameters, what kind of configurations can we get, okay? So everything here is described in terms of these ratios of the repulsive and attractive length scales, and the repulsive and attractive amplitudes, okay? And all this is saying is that basically if I live in this box over here, okay, the system over here, this is catastrophic, meaning here the system is too attractive, okay? Particles tend to collapse to a point if I have many, many of them. If I don't have very many of them, then you'll gradually see these structures decreasing, okay? And that's why in those mills that I showed you, right, the more particles you put, the more they start, they become a little bit bigger, okay? So it means that those pictures that we saw before, where again, the more particles I have, the smaller these mills become, it means that the parameters came somewhere from here. And vice versa, if you pick parameters that come somewhere from here, you might expect these mills to start shrinking, okay? So this is the catastrophic behavior, and this is instead the stable part, where instead, on the other hand, you can see these structures actually being extensive in nature, meaning the more particles you put, the larger the structures will become, okay? So this is just, however, looking at this system without actually looking at these alpha over beta. And now we're going to take all this and we're going to apply alpha and beta and see what patterns we get together with that. Okay, and so we're going to start looking at from this particular area of the phase diagram. And what you see here is that this is, if we start from this particular box over here, the potential actually has this particular shape here. And what you see is that basically we are here in the catastrophic regime. The system is way too attractive. And what you see is that the more particles I put, the tighter these structures will become. Okay, so right, they start coalescing until they actually do collapse onto a point. And also you see here that everybody is rotating about the center of mass because of this alpha over beta constraint. Okay, particles are moving at a fixed speed. The direction is not fixed, but the speed is fixed. Okay, so here you see 40 particles, they're all one on top of each other, and they are rotating about their center of mass. Okay.
Would there be some, confused, in terms of catastrophe, I would have thought that, does that model, I'm surprised that the number
for
of
us,
particles...
For us, catastrophe means everything coalescing to a point. That's
right. But with 40 particles, will they not eventually just coalesce to a point?
No, because again, they have this motion of alpha over beta that's keeping them in rotation. Okay. Remember, they have an intrinsic speed that they're satisfied, that they're moving at. So they're rotating about the center of mass with their speed, and the interactions are such that they assemble in this way.
And that's,
sorry,
go ahead, please.
No, go ahead.
Right. No, I was just going to say, so what's keeping them from that center of mass, from coalescing to that point? Because you could imagine that they would keep the same momentum, but would eventually just coalesce to the point. Which is
well, because they also have these interactions among them. So, right, they are...
it's repulsion, right?
They, there's an attraction and a repulsive
keeping the
term.
Keeping the Earth from colliding with the sun.
It just follows from the equations of Boyle. So it's basically, again, it's a give and take between the interactions between these particles and the fact that they have to move at a certain speed. Okay, so what you're saying basically happens here. Okay, so basically there's not enough of them here for them to coalesce to a point and keep that, you know, that motion going. Whereas here, right, there's enough of them to actually all collapse to a point and just keep doing this motion kind of locally. So that's what you see here.
So if you would have particles of finite size, then these catastrophic conditions would never be
right. Okay? Correct. Yes. Because then you have a hard core, okay? And hard core will not allow you to be one on top of each other. In fact, when you have hard core, you always have a finite distance between particles. Hence, right, by definition, the system will be extensive, right? Okay. So then you can move to this other part of the phase diagram here. And you see also that this is a catastrophic system. Again, the more particles you put, the more the structures become tighter. But there is an intrinsic minimum in your potential here. And so what you see is that actually particles assemble with this interparticle distance that is almost zero. So basically, they neatly assemble into a ring. Okay. And again, the more particles you have, the tighter these rings become. You can actually even go calculate the radius of that ring analytically, and it matches very nicely with your numerical results. Okay.
What's the difference between disks and rings?
Well, a ring is that it's empty inside. A disk is when it's all full.
Yeah. So why does it make a ring? Don't they want? They want. Okay. I suppose they still want to be close to one another.
Right. But again, they still have this motion going. So it's the motion that basically they have to keep this velocity going. And the way that they kind of optimize this is, again, by assembling into this ring pattern so that they can move at this finite speed. Okay. Now, here instead, right, there is the potential that they start with has got an intrinsic minimum. So particles do like to have some separation between them, okay, slightly like the case of the just like before, but just that it's non-zero. So here what you will see is instead these clumps forming, okay? Particles by themselves will have some kind of interparticle distance forming, and they all rotate about their center of mass, okay? So here you see 40 of these particles rotating about the center of mass. Here it's 100, there it's 150. And if you keep on going, they're actually going to form a blob, okay? And the fact that here you see 2 and here you see 4 is because of the particular initial conditions, okay? You will always see them in even numbers, at least the simulations that we've tried, okay? And as the number of particles increases, this intraparticle separation becomes smaller, both inside the clumps and, you know, within the clumps itself. Okay, and eventually everything will collapse to a particular formation. Okay, and over here, so what we looked at right now are these you know, locations here. Here we're not going to look at this. In this case here, the system is way too repulsive, and so basically they're going to occupy the entire volume that you give them, and basically they will never form any pattern of aggregation. Okay,
maybe related to this question. So theoretically, then you could say here's a situation where everything collapses. But then you can, whatever the correct term is, you can fiddle around with your equations, and you can say, but if I change this thing about particles, then I could keep them from never.
Yes, exactly. So the point of this is that I'm able.
Guys,
yes, I can tweak my numbers so that I know exactly what configuration I'm going to get. That was the whole point of this. And whereas down here, right, these are actually the most interesting parts of your phase diagram. And these are the simulations that we saw at the very beginning, okay? So this part over here, on top of the curve, this is the first simulation I showed you, which had that rigid disk that was forming, okay? And here what you see is that the system is stable, and it means that, right, the more particles I put into the system, the larger it becomes. And so we have, right, these disks that basically keep increasing if I put more and more particles in, or depending on initial conditions, but very, very rarely, I may find flocks, okay? This is a very, very rare occurrence. Most of the times we see this, okay? And what you see here is that something strange happens, which is that, right, if you have a rigid disk like this, where basically everybody, these intraparticle distances are kept fixed, okay? And you think of this thing rotating here, you can actually think that the velocity of these particles is going to be proportional to the radius, okay? The further I am from the origin, the faster I have to go to keep this rigid disk formation, okay? But this means that the constraint alpha over beta is not kept, v squared equals to alpha over beta is not kept anymore, okay? So this results in the fact that if you want to keep this structure going, you constantly have to keep pumping in energy from the environment and pushing it back out, okay? And that's why in this particular case, the structure does not stay still. It keeps, the center of mass keeps moving around, okay? Because again, I'm always pumping energy in and out. The dV by dt is not zero. And, you know, as a whole, the structure has got a non-zero motion for its center of mass, okay? Here instead, this is,
sure.
Yeah.
So as an experimentalist, I guess I wouldn't be surprised with the sentence you just said. So you're saying that you have this simulation, you run it many, many times, but you don't always get the same results.
Depending on initial conditions?
Well,
depending on what?
When you said occasionally you
right.
see...
Yes, and this is because
the
initial...
starts out the
no,
same?
No. Everything, meaning the same except for the initial conditions. Okay, so if the initial conditions are random, like everything is random,
yeah.
Most of the time, like 99% of the time, you'll see this. Okay, if they're random, I mean, if they're random but not quite so random, meaning that they're almost like this already, then they will form a flocking situation. Okay, but most of the time, you'll see this. Okay, again, if you start it like this, it will stay like this. Okay, but it has to really be close to this particular configuration. Okay,
so in any given model, can you track? So you start with conditions, and then you have a set of interactions that you're modeling, or sort of at like time one, and then the next time you calculate those conditions, they're slightly different, and that produces the behavior. So can you track how the conditions are changing to get to a certain sort of behavior?
Which conditions?
Any of the conditions that you're, so you're saying I'm starting with your, in certain starting conditions,
right,
and then those conditions then change according to your equations,
right?
So you get to a stable behavior.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Right? So when you track, though, is the model essentially giving you how those conditions change? Sort of like how you find a local maximum or a local minimum in parameter space. Is that?
Okay, well, there's two things here. You can keep the same parameters, okay, and
right.
just change the initial conditions, right? Just I start them slightly different, and the same parameters will give me, you know, in potentially speaking, you know, different behaviors just because I started from a different set of, you know, realizations.
Right.
Or you can keep the same initial conditions and just change the parameters.
Okay, so I'm using the word parameters and conditions.
Okay.
I'm using them wrong.
Okay.
What I mean is, When, so you have starting conditions.
Okay.
And then at time zero, and then at time one, those conditions are going to have different numerical values. Is that correct?
The positions of the particles have different, okay, the parameters stay always the same. I'm not going to change them during my simulation.
Right.
What I have are initial conditions, mm-hmm. and these things, meaning I have particles at certain positions with certain speeds. Okay.
Right.
Then I follow those equations, yeah. and at the next time step, the particle, instead of being here, is going to be here with another speed.
Right.
Okay. And then I do it again until it stays.
Right. And so then
integration.
Can you then sort of track those conditions to move to the point where you start getting a coalescing around a certain solution? Is that right? And so the model is essentially, I'm trying to understand this as if, you know, a tree search through likelihood space, right? And you make decisions about, well, if it's a better solution, then you keep it, or if it's a worse solution, then you don't. And
all I'm saying is that if I decide to live anywhere in this box, let's say,
yeah.
as parameter space, okay?
Right.
I pick the C, the L, the all those things,
right.
such that I'm in this box here,
yeah.
okay? Then if I start from any random, almost any initial random condition, almost any, where the particles can be anywhere that they like,
right?
But they have to be close enough that they talk to each other.
Okay, so the
I will end up in something like this.
Right, so the parameters are how the conditions move. The conditions are the particular configuration of points that you start with.
Yes, we can think of it like that, yes, okay?
I really apologize, guys, because
at the very beginning, at the very beginning of all this, I picked these numbers, C A L A C R L R, with the potential and
right.
alpha and beta.
Right,
okay?
And that's how any of these points are going to move in the next time.
Right, and I'm somewhere here, yes. So at T equals 1, I take those equations, I look at the particles that are anywhere that they like, and they move according to some rules. And they keep always moving, but the values of the C's are always the same, okay? And they keep evolving until at the end I end up with this.
Right.
And this is mostly independent of the way I started the system, as long as A, the system is such that particles are close enough that they talk to each other, or else they will just, you know, go far apart. And B, if they start, there's a very, very small special subset of initial conditions, which is if they start close enough to something that looks like this, they will stay like this, okay? But this is very, very difficult to realize from random conditions, okay?
Maybe in your language, may I translate?
Yes,
so
please.
Please.
If you have a probability distribution of the positions and the velocities, the system is self-organizing itself into the most likely state. It's finding the most likely
right.
state by itself.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
It's called actually a basin of attraction, right? It's like where all initial conditions will basically take you.
Right. And so in sort of analogy to that issue of sort of likelihood space, do you find some sets of, or some either models or conditions where you have multiple peaks, and so you get stuck on a local maximum.
Right. So here, there's only two. There's only two. Okay. Which are these two possibilities? In fact, this one here, energetically speaking, this is better. This has got a lower global energy. This is better to achieve from an energetic point of view,
right.
because here the center of mass, right? It just basically keeps moving at a constant speed as a flock. And you're not really pumping anything or pushing anything anymore. Everybody's moving at the same speed, and so, you know, V squared is equal to alpha over beta, okay? Once they reach that velocity, they will keep it, and they're good to go, okay? But here instead, this has got a higher energy, okay? But it's easier to assemble into because of the fact that disorder, this is easier, if you start from a disordered state, this is easier to find than that. Okay? So energetically speaking, this is better than that, but this is easier to assemble into.
And that
so you're
never,
be stuck.
Turns,
you're
that
be stuck
never transitions into the flow?
No. Unless you...
Probability zero.
Well, it's a very, very small probability, at least in 2D.
Because you're not maximizing based on energy.
This is the maximum entropy state, if you like. There's no entropy here, but if you want to try
sure.
the analogy, that's what you find.
Yeah.
The barrier to get from the right side
right.
to the left
right.
is too large. You don't cross it because you don't have enough
right.
time or energy.
could I make a comment about modeling, though? Because about what's in and what's out, because I think this is what Joel was asking earlier on. Like, you see, you've got two things, right? You've got the particles know how fast they want to go because they're trying to go at their preferred speed.
Right.
And then also they have a preferred distance as well.
Correct.
And so this is what emerges with those rules. But we've also learned from what's not in the model. So we've learned that if you don't have a finite particle size, then you tend to collapse to a point. And so we probably learned that if we want to do modeling of a bacterial swarm or something, or a flock of birds, we should probably add that.
If you don't have a finite, if you have a finite size, you will not collapse.
Therefore, we probably conclude that that's an important part of the rule.
But if you do not, if you have a zero finite size, you can still get non-collapsing behavior. It doesn't work two ways; just a one-way assertion. So if you have zero particle size, you can still get structures that do not collapse.
The real bacteria have a size.
Yes,
so
of course.
Might as well put that into our model.
Of course.
And the other thing is that's noticeable then is if flocks are rare, that's probably because they can't see where the other particles are going. Right? They know how far away they are.
I'll show you that in 3D. This actually doesn't. Everything changes in 3D. Okay, and I'll show you that in just a moment. It's because this is an easier, configuration to assemble into. And again, it's this business of overcoming the barrier. Once you settle into this, it's going to be really hard to go back into that. So you're basically, as you were saying before, you're stuck here. It's not that you can.
Imagine adding a rule that says I want to go the same speed as my at the same direction as my neighbor. Right. So then.
But right, locally here, you're kind of going at the same speed as your neighbor locally, okay? But globally, you can't, it's still not satisfied globally.
Okay. I was saying that you were getting those things when you were two.
Right.
Going in opposite directions at the same time, right?
Right, but that, okay.
So they wouldn't do that if they knew which direction that their neighbors were going. If they said, I'm going to take the average of my few neighbors and try and move in the same direction.
Right, but that argument goes together also with the speed at which you're going, because maybe you're going too fast to actually change the direction. So actually that's what I'll show you that in just a moment, that basically if you're going too fast, these counter-rotating mills can exist. But there's not enough time for them to interact so that they both go in the same way. They basically keep on going with the speed that they have. Okay, so now, if we live down here instead, this is where the system has this catastrophic behavior. The particles have a preferred distance at which they want to live, and so they'll basically, keep milling around here with the hole at the center. Also here, if initial conditions and very, very rare cases will give you this flocking behavior, but most of the time what we see are the emergence of these core-free milling structures, okay? And this is, the simulation that we have seen before, okay? And here all the particles want to go at the speed v squared equals to alpha over beta, okay? And so the core emerges, because if you think about it, if the velocity is constant, and you're also thinking it in terms of, angular rotation, like v equals to omega r, if r is almost zero, the velocity has got to be infinitely large. So basically the system responds by not putting anybody in this circle over here. Okay? So it stays empty of particles. Okay? And you can see this in many other ways of representing this. For example, this is the area of your vortex as a function of the number of particles. As the number of particles increases, the area goes down. And the same thing happens if you look at the inner radius, the outer radius, and if you look at this also as a function of alpha, which is the self-propelling speed of the particles, you see the same thing. So basically here, alpha is fixed at a certain value. For 90 particles, you see a larger area than you see for 600 particles. So basically, right, these are the catastrophic cases. You increase particles, and things become tighter and tighter and tighter. And what's also interesting is that if you look at this as a function of alpha, you see that these curves stop at a certain point. Okay, here, just some data is missing because for whatever reason, we didn't really put it in, but they all stop at some point. And it's not that they stop because we stop taking data. It's because at some point, the structures don't hold anymore. Basically, this alpha, the self-propelling speed, becomes too high. The particles are going too fast. And basically, they're able to escape the attraction of others. And these structures basically end up collapsing. Okay. And you can, again, have estimates for those kinds of behaviors. Okay. And then again, you can actually do the same kind of game with other kinds of potential. As we said before, you can add a diverging component to that in the denominator. You can look at, again, hard disks, like we were saying before, where they have this finite size, or Leonard Jones kinds of potentials. These are always stable, okay? Meaning they do never collapse. They never never have this shrinking quality to them, okay? And you can also look at Bessel K functions, which also have these different regimes of collapse and stability.
Let me ask a question. I mean, these self-propelled particles, like bacteria, often they have also a potential which is depending on the direction of the particles approaching them. Right. Not only depends on the distance between the particles, okay, but also on the direction.
Okay, so sometimes people have, we didn't put that in. Yeah. People have done that with what are called Kuker-Smale potentials, where basically they have this alignment, like Vi minus Vj kind of thing. And you see different kinds of patterns and different kinds of potentials depending on these, the prefactor in front of this Vi minus Vj term.
So the analysis would not be robust against changes in that?
Well, you would have to, you would have to go and do the details of these calculations. I don't know. I mean, right, if you have an alignment tendency, Vi minus Vj, it's going to be very rare that you'll see milling structures, right, because everybody wants to move at the same direction. So these kinds of forces, I would guess, tend, might favor the emergence of flocks, right? Okay, just because, it comes back to what you put in is what you put out, okay? If I force them to align with each other, then of course I'll see this alignment, okay? Okay, now, you can do other things, and
I wouldn't say it like this. I mean, one knows a lot about those particles and about their interactions. So once you put in what one knows about them, then ask whether the behavior observed is robust, small changes in the behavior of this interaction potential. Like you do, you say that the interaction potential, its shape doesn't matter. All that matters is the integral, whether it's catastrophic or not. But then you say, well, these particles have a tendency to align. So I would ask myself, how important is that alignment, and how strong does it have to be as compared to the positive or attractive interaction, such that your vortices are actually robust features of such systems? That's right. The question I would have.
Right. Well, again, one would have to go, just look at these in details and see, right, how much the, I don't even think that people have put in together these two trends, because they kind of the self-propelling term and the Vi minus Vj, I don't think that they've actually put them in together, because, right, they're kind of counter, right? There's two different tendencies. So I don't know what would come out of, maybe I would think that also in this case, it's going to depend a lot on the initial conditions probably, because also usually in these Kuker-Smale terms, right, Vi minus Vj has got a prefactor in front, which is also, inversely proportional to the distance. So if they're far enough that Vi minus Vj is not strongly felt, then perhaps it's going to be the self-propelling term that wins, because that is independent of your neighbors, right? It only is something that has to do with how you interact with your environment. Whereas probably if they start close enough, probably, they will go with Vi minus Vj, and Vi might maybe equal to Vj and equal to alpha over beta square root, right? Because the two things can actually live together, but, along a flock, so I don't know.
You mentioned interacting with the environment.
Right. That's alpha and beta.
Right. But do you calculate the differential ability of a point to interact with the environment the closer they are to the center of the disk or flock?
What's the differentiability?
As in something that is on the inside is potentially not going to be able, going to be able to interact with signals from the outside the flock less than something that's, say, on the surface, right? I mean, the outer ring.
Right, but
the outer
environment, but so that are interactions between particles. That's the term I and J.
Right.
And here, the way this is modeled, right, again, is that, as we said, everything is exponentially decaying. So I really always mostly interact with my closest neighbors. When I talk about the environment, it assumes that every particle has got the capability, wherever it is, of, again, pumping energy in and out to whatever environment this is.
Right, yeah, and I guess I was thinking, for example, there's a fellow in Switzerland who had a series of papers showing that cells that have grown sort of in clump, not in clumps, but I mean, essentially, as you start growing groups of cells, we always assume that gene expression, protein expression, behavior is the same in all cells in a dish, and he was showing significant differences if the cell was on the outer edge, because it had just a lot more accessibility to the medium, as opposed to if it's inside, you know, and you were showing the bacteria on a plate, a bacterial cell that's in the middle of that colony has a very different environment than a cell that's on the outside. And whether you take that into account in the model.
Right, all these structures that emerge do not have any leader. There is no preferred anything. So basically, when we start, they're all the same. And
we
just end up, you know, in this particular. So maybe we could give certain particles special properties compared to others, but we don't do that.
No, that's not what I'm asking. I guess what I'm saying is, if at T1, or at any given time point in your simulation, that the variables would be different, or the conditions, the set of the conditions would be different based on where you are in that disk. If you are on the outer edge of the disk, then you will have a certain, I guess, A and B, whereas if you're on the inner edge, you would have a different A and B. So it's not that they have leaders, that the points have different properties,
but they're positional.
Right,
how do you know which one is going to be on the outside and which one is going to be on the inside?
Well, isn't that what you're calculating?
Well, right, we see that, but at the beginning, they're all the same. We don't know at the beginning
who's
there. So,
right, but I guess
we don't differentiate between them.
Right, but
and actually, okay.
So, no, it's okay. It's okay. It's all good. Yeah.
Can I ask you another question?
Yeah.
Is this a different topic?
No, this is basically, so what we have is this Morse potential. Everything that I showed you is if the particles interact according to this law over here. Now you can reproduce the same kind of arguments if you take different kinds of interactions. For example, you can add a fraction here, okay? You can have different kinds of functions. You can add what are these hard disks, where basically there is a core at which you cannot penetrate between these particles. You can have Lennard-Jones, right, R6, R12, kind of, repulsion and attraction. And these are the behaviors that you will see, okay? So basically, you can look at this in another way. Okay. Now, sometimes, and again, we won't really go this into detail, you think, okay, I have a lot of particles and I don't necessarily want to look at this one by one. So here we were following the motion of every particle I, okay, and now they're all interacting. So there are techniques that take you from discrete systems to continuous systems, where instead of looking at particles with their position and their velocities, you actually look at their densities, and I won't get into that, right? At the density, this tells you how many particles you have at position r times t, and the velocity field, okay, of that density field at position r and t, okay? You have ways of defining these things through your microscopic quantities. For example, right, this is the mass of little particles, this is their momentum, etc. Okay. So you can, apply all this machinery to our system, and at the end of the day, you will end up with, instead of having 100 equations for your 100, actually 200 equations for 100 particles, right, actually multiplied by 3 because, or 2 or 3, depending on the dimensions in which you're living, you actually only have these, right, one equation here for the density, and 2 or 3 equations, depending on your dimensionality, for the velocity. Okay? And this can be sometimes easier to look at. And in fact, if you imposed by hand, that particles are going to rotate in the smell. So you give them a rotational speed, okay? You force that on them. You have some implicit equation for your density, which you can actually solve numerically, and you will see that the profile of this radius, which is in the continuum field, which is the red, the black curve, is not too dissimilar from what we see from the discrete, which is instead the red curve. Okay. Of course, right, they don't exactly match, but again, this is a continuous scaling, this is only 400 particles. So, you know, considering the fact that more or less the width of this mill is the same and that they both have, you know, an empty core at the beginning, it kind of, right, matches nicely what we see in the discrete case. Okay. You can also do other nice things with these continuous equations. You can, for example, impose a uniform solution, okay, where basically a density is uniform and everybody's moving at the same speed, okay, and this is basically the macroscopic, the continuous equivalent of a flock, right? Everybody is the same and they're moving at the same speed, and you can ask yourself, you know, how does this thing get perturbed? And what you see is that the uniform solution is perturbed in exactly the same spots of the phase diagram as the system showed catastrophic behavior. And that's because, right, when you are catastrophic, you tend to collapse to a point, and that's also the same, you know, situation where your uniform solution is not stable anymore. Okay, so the patterns match, and you can also look at this, right? If you have a lot of particles, you can see that these are your discrete simulations and these are the continuous ones, and you see, right, that they kind of go nicely together. Here, alpha is zero, so basically at the end of the day, particles will stop. They don't have enough, you know, energy pumped in from the environment, and here instead alpha is one, so you will see actually these stripes of, you know, flogging situations, okay?
Are these Turing instabilities?
Huh?
Are these Turing instabilities?
Well, they come from these, from the, are, you know, a continuous equation, so there's no...
There's a band of unstable mode.
Well, I don't, it's actually just what we find from these equations here, so we didn't really, you know, go too much into it. It was just, you know, looking at the velocity field, and it just turned out to look like that. Okay. You can also look at this from kinetic theory, which, you know, actually shows that, in fact, you can have, in certain cases, these counter-rotating mills. But again, let's not get into that. And then you can, you know, apply other types of, you know, little tweaks to your system. You can apply, for example, noise, okay? And what you see with noise is quite interesting. So if you start with a flock, okay, where everything is ordered, okay? And again, this is a flock, so the center of mass is moving, and this axis over here represents noise that is increased at regular time intervals, okay? So this is time and noise at the same time. So your flock will keep moving up until a certain point where the noise is too high, and basically the flock stops, and you will end up in some, you know, kind of blob motion, okay? And that's, again, beyond a certain critical value of noise. You can actually, if you want to decide in which way your mills rotate, you can actually apply some sort of magnetic field, which tells you in which direction they're going to rotate. Let's see if I can find this. All right, so one of them will rotate counterclockwise, and the other one will rotate the other way. Okay, so these are exactly the same initial conditions. Everything is the same. It's just that in one case we have this H positive, and the other case we have H negative, and they basically allow you to decide which rotational hand you want. Okay, it's just another term that you put in your equations if you want to find these different behaviors.
So there are some bacteria that follow magnetic fields. They move along magnetic fields. They don't move perpendicular. Your magnetic
field. Well, I put it like that because I wanted to. But I was calling it a magnetic field. It's just a term that allows me to pick which rotation.
Yes,
I can actually call it clockwise or counterclockwise, right?
Yeah.
It's just making you rotate in a certain direction.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. There was an example that I've heard that we've heard in the last week or so where there was, it was Wallace.
Wallace,
yeah.
Every
yes.
Yeah, you've got something weird. No, but they had, there was rotational behavior, and they could not explain what the handedness was, right?
It was from the centrioles.
Okay, I mean, I wonder if that this might, could this be used to explain that? I'd have to remember what it was. But
I want to make sure we have enough time to ask these kinds of, we these kinds of questions about how can we think about this in terms of things that actually are observed in biology.
Okay, then let's show a few more slides. I won't get into the 3D. I'll just say very little about the 3D part. Okay, how about that? Okay, I just wanted to show you that you can do all sorts of other decorations. For example, you can decide that your masses are different. Okay, if the masses are different, basically some are higher than the others, then you will see. Oh, we won't see this. Great. Okay, let's see now.
Well, this is back to normal, right? Because this just like a great, you know, they couldn't explain it.
I mean, for bacteria, there's all high Reynolds numbers, low Reynolds numbers, there's no mass.
So these plots show
mass
nothing?
Mass is completely irrelevant.
But was it, I don't think it was bacteria.
What's that?
In this case?
I can't remember.
Okay.
I can't remember. So, right, if you wait, you know, the colors here go with the rainbow, and basically the particles with the lower mass are the purple ones, and the particles with the higher mass are the red ones. And you see that they nicely assemble in such a way that the particles with lower mass are nested in the center. Okay, and you can actually understand this just by, you know, some qualitative argument that if you think that, right, the mass times the acceleration is given by some interactions which, let's say, are more or less the same for everybody, and your mv squared over r is just, and v squared is just alpha over beta, you can see, right, if this is more or less constant, then you can say that the mass is going to be proportional to r, right? R goes on the other side, and m is, you know, somehow, you know, related to r. So larger mass means larger radius, and smaller mass means smaller radius. Same thing, well, I don't know if we can see. This is just a little game. You can have special sites, and we tried to do that, and it's the same thing. You know, the other pictures don't really mean anything. It was, they were just control. Okay, sorry about that. Okay. And this is nice because, again, it goes back to this thing that initial conditions may give you different kinds of structures. And so right here you see that, you know, just by chance, it took us a long time to find this, you can end up in a flock, and that is a male structure over there that stays put. And well, actually I don't know why this stopped, but you would have seen that it's going to, anyway, it was going to it was going to avoid the central guy, who is a purely repulsive point. Okay, so nobody likes to be next to him. You can actually decide that there's a okay, this one here instead, is that you have a point here that is strongly attractive. But the range of interaction is very, very limited. And you will see that, right, particles, the flock, you know, just overshoots a little bit. And then some of them are able to talk to the particle here. And the rest are not directly talking to the red box. They are just, right, you know, information gets propagated, you know, from all between all these layers until eventually they all nicely assemble into the mill into a mill formation around the red dot. Okay, that's if you want to, right, use this as a target. And well, you can add chemotaxis, but you can make all these particles, right, follow a certain food gradient from the center, and they'll just quickly converge to that particular point if you wanted to do that. And just in the interest of time.
So it was sense electrical patterns, galvanotaxis, skin cells that are wounded, and somehow they can respond to an electrical field. The magnet was just that looking at spindles and magnets.
It was a rotational thing. Because I remember him saying they tried this in Australia, and they also tried it upside down, and they couldn't change the rotation.
I actually remember that. He said something about the Australia, the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah, no, it was the Australia and the space part that made me sort of like remember that, right? But
Well, but right, all of these, I mean, again, you just have to kind of, you know, decide what it is that you're interested in, and then, you know, just introduce these terms and see how they kind of compete or interact with the ones that are already there. Mm-hmm. So that's all.
So if you were trying to use this to, I don't know, to explain, like, those ants, that thing that you just talked about, the ants, right? So you could make a model, you think, and then you could say, what could you say? How could you take this kind of information and actually, like, apply it to understanding what's happening in some real world?
Well, I mean, first of all, you would have to really understand if the interactions that we introduce are really the way that these particles are interacting. For example, right? I mean, ants usually lay down, you know, some chemical trails. So you would have to introduce this chemotactic field into it, right? So I don't know if this is the way, this is the only way to do it, right? Okay. And then again, you would have to tweak things.
It would have to be a system that was simple enough that you could actually quantify.
Right, or vice versa, if there was really some element that you knew that was really important, then you should add it in the best way that you can. But again, this was just, again, a mathematician or a physicist way of trying to, again, categorize different kinds of behaviors.
But couldn't you at least say something like, you know, with those ants, it's not like there's like one leader ant and right. Everybody was following him. I guess you couldn't say that, but you could say it doesn't have to be that there was like one guy leading.
Right.
Because in your, you can start with these random movements and you can generate that. Does that make sense?
Right, but I don't know if those ants, right, if, you know, again, if those ants in that particular case were, you know, searching for something and somebody found it and then
you can describe the ants, you can say you don't have to invoke a system where the head ant leads everybody on this pattern.
Right, no,
of
course.
Because it's possible to generate it in this way.
Yes, you can certainly say that.
And could you then use that, you know, that suggests that there are certain types of behaviors which you could then describe and say, well, if it's this kind of behavior, is that. Could you then, and then you could go and test that by saying, if that is true, then we should also see the following kinds of behavior in ant colonies.
Correct. No, you know, at some point I actually asked,
So you could say, if the ants were bigger, if the ants were smaller.
But then it's also.
So at some point I read somewhere that this mixosant of bacteria, okay, the ones that form these stalking things, right? Before they form the stalk, if you put them on a dish, okay, they will form counter-rotating mills with the hole in the middle, and these particles do not lay down any chemicals, okay? So I thought, this is the perfect system that I'm kind of modeling, right? Counterclockwise, and actually, the you know, as the number of these particles, you know, becomes bigger, they actually shrink until the little tree comes, you know, forms. So I thought, this is the perfect system. So I talked to some biologists that was studying this organism. I said, okay, how do these things interact? If you take two of them, what are the typical, you know, spacings that they keep? What are the, you know, how do they interact with one another? Can you tell me what the equivalent of these CA, CR, LALR are? And they just didn't tell me. They told me it was just too complicated to be able to answer this kind of question. I don't know if that's true or not, but this is, you know, that to me would have been the most natural system of looking at this because
they have a lab here where they visualize bacteria like growing one or two at a time. I mean, if you could get, I don't know if it's capable to culture that particular bacteria under conditions, but like use the microscope, but that might be a way of.
Well, sure. I mean, I'm all, you know, open to, you know, understanding this, and if we could just decide, right, how do they.
Yeah.
So that actually would be wonderful. I would really like that.
I mean, it's interesting, the idea of the mass, right? I mean, because one of the things when you're looking at fish think in some way. And maybe that's a good, no. But I guess I'm trying to figure out whether it's better to have a thinking system, but not too smart, right? As in, it's sort of predictable, right? Fish, if you do this, then there's input, there's output, but that, despite what maybe sort of currents, right? It'll fight environmental things that will just completely, you know, a big wave washes away your physical things, right? They fight against that, right? So there's simple decision making. But on the other hand, something much, much smaller, like actin monomers in a cell, would they have the same behavior? They're not thinking, they're just.
So you tell us whether what we're saying is like completely crazy.
active filaments on the motility assay, they have the same behavior. Okay. You can do, you can take, use a motility assay where you have myosin.
Right.
And they're sticking up in the air.
Right.
Grabbing actin filaments.
Okay.
And you just put many of them.
Yeah.
And then these many actin filaments would collide.
Okay.
And then you form these kind of nice structures.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Great.
Okay. The interaction you have between the actin filaments is anything but the pairwise interaction.
Right.
It really, you know, they may overlap like that, and the third or fourth filament might be part of it.
Yeah.
So the theoretical description is quite difficult, quite complex.
Right.
But the genuine feature you see is flocks, density waves, vortices, things like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because that would...
So you don't need a brain.
No, but that's exactly right. I mean, what that does is it eliminates the possibility of it's just a fish that's a little off.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So the question of whether they know where their neighbors are going could occur in several ways as well. I mean, if you're a fish, you can see whether you're going in the same direction as everybody else or the opposite way, right? If you're an actin molecule, probably you can tell from viscosity or something. I mean, this molecule is going this way, and it has some viscous force that's dragging the other one the same way. So even without a brain, you can probably tell whether you're going opposite or the same way as your neighbor, for example.
Yeah, Right, but all these elements need to sort of be put into the, you know, the model in the way. I mean, if this is a very general model, right? They're just point particles that obey just these very simple laws, and they all obey the same kind of right equations of motion. So, if you want to specialize, then you kind of have to introduce whatever it is that you're interested in.
So, sample where you actually can use the model as you have it for the actual system is granular media.
Say it again.
It's granular media. So what you do is you just create some little disc-shaped objects, say a millimeter size, and you make them such that they have some soft material underneath and some hard metal material on top. And then you put them on a shaker.
Okay.
And on top of it, a plate. And then you shake this thing. And then these particles start moving and they start colliding. And then you can actually characterize the pairwise interaction between these granules.
Right, but what about the self-propelling term? How would they self-propel?
They self-propel because you make them asymmetric. So what you do is you have a disc like that, and the bottom there is in the back some broad rubber-like material, and the front you have a pin, so you make it like a shoe. And then you create an asymmetry in this particle, and now you're putting in energy by vibrating the plate, and this makes each of those granular particles perform a persistent random walk in the same way as the self-propelled particles show persistent random walks. And in that case, you can specify the pairwise interaction, and then do a simulation based on that pairwise interaction, and then compare the theory predictions with the experimental outcome.
Have people seen patterns in these systems?
Yeah, okay. I can show you.
Okay, sure. That would be interesting.
They have seen swirls and all kinds of patterns.
So they have seen them. Okay.
Depends a lot, though, on the geometry, because these systems you have to actually perform the experiment of finite size, right?
Right, of course.
Even the people who have these systems, infinite in size, they have finite size, so the boundary matters.
But it might be particularly useful if you could nanofabricate these things.
Yeah.
It would be potentially quite useful for nanotechnology.
Yeah, that's an idea.
Yeah.
People are trying to do this. They actually engineer magnetic particles, and they put DNA origami on the back. Okay. So make a tail like a flagella of bacteria,
right.
And then they use a magnetic field to turn the magnetic particles, and then this DNA origami thing starts whipping.
Yeah.
And that's via that, they create spinless.
Well, I was just thinking, how do you get a nano motor, right? Without, but if you can create swirls.
Yeah.
right?
They're
in
very slow. Though.
Yeah. Oh, they're really slow.
Yeah, so that they don't compare with myosin and kinesin. They're much better. But that's the direction people are thinking, to engineer those things on a nano scale.
Okay, well, I don't think there's time to say anything in 3D, so let me just. Yes.
So, it was the cells rotating, the directionality of cells rotating. That was the thing that was done in.
Yeah. So what was that?
Neutrophils. The nucleus centrosome axis. 90% of the cells move to the left of this axis. And it has to do with the centriole. So if you ablate the centriole, so the centriole has some sort of set asymmetry.
Yeah,
right?
Right.
So that was, yeah. I think that was the one where he said they went to Australia.
Yeah.
But so it was actually intrinsic to the.
That's cool.
Not magnetic, not electrostatic.
Okay, then that's it. And thank you for your patience.
That was great.
Thank you. It's very interesting.